Let's sit. No more. Let's learn. Let's evolve. Let's talk. Today is no Let's Talk Social Justice with your host, Kevin Yowie.
Good morning. You're listening to AAA Murray Country. That's right. It's Tuesday morning. I'm Kevin Yowie, and that means on Let's Talk, we're yarning all things social justice. But as a Waka Waka and South Sea Islander man, I am, of course, a visitor to this country where the AAA studios sit here in West End, and would therefore like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners, caretakers and custodians of this land and pay my respect to their old people, past and present, and acknowledge that their sovereignty has never been ceded. These past few weeks, it's been a pleasure to talk to some staunch mob from around so-called Australia who work on the front lines, who agitate, who theorise and who strategise on ways to overcome the housing crisis that we know is sweeping throughout the continent. For listeners who've been tuning in to Let's Talk Social Justice over the past couple of weeks, we've already heard a bunch of critical perspectives on housing justice and what it means to think about housing in the context of continuing colonisation. We, of course, had Lorna Munro, Alan Van Nieuwen and Kylie Dean from West End Community House just around the corner. And if you've missed any of these shows, know that you can catch up by heading over to the AAA website. You can also find us on Spotify. By now, most of our listeners will know, possibly even firsthand, that it is increasingly difficult to find affordable, quality housing in most cities in so-called Australia. For everyday people, housing costs have skyrocketed, with affordable rental properties now almost impossible for anyone living on payments like Newstart or JobSeeker or disability support payments. And rising rents aren't the only ways that people are getting stuck without adequate housing. This week, we're looking into the ways that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples with disabilities are getting stuck outside and without access to safe and secure housing. We're very lucky to be joined by Debbie Lee from the First Peoples Disability Network, who is going to give us a bit more insight into how and why Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people living with disabilities are being specifically and disproportionately impacted by the current housing crisis. Debbie, welcome to Let's Talk Social Justice.
Hey there, my brother, and thank you for having me on the show. And look, I'd like to acknowledge my elders, past, present and future, and I'm a king, and I'm actually a Yalandji Gomeroi Djalbu, and I live in New South Wales. So every day I walk into lands, but yeah, look, thank you for having us on the show, brother.
So, it's a real pleasure.
Thank you. Just opening up the floor for a yarn is a good way to start here. But I think, one of the things that is impacting our mob, which we're not hearing enough of from our Australian government, is the issues around poverty.
Ooh.
So, you know, as we all know that many of our families were displaced in the floods, but, we've seen changes in housing well before that time, Kevin.
Yeah.
Because, it goes, if I only talk of the New South Wales state, so, we go back 3 or 4 years ago when the bushfires came.
Yeah, true. Yeah, that wasn't too long ago, was it?
No. So, look, we had a lot of families that were displaced back then. And, obviously it created a lot of health issues for mob who did have homes at that point in time. But as we know, over the last 3 or 4 years, that housing has gotten significantly worse. And, if it's fair to be honest, I'd have to say that, the private rental market has gotten even difficult for our families, because what we have seen is a lot of increased racism. We've also seen increased opportunities for landlords to actually, I suppose, cherry pick and, pick and choose. But not only that, there is an absolute flavour in the market now that, if another family comes along and, they might have a better income, they'll offer a higher amount of money.
Yeah. Rent. Yeah, you see that happen a lot. I know even recently me and my partner had to move, and because the owners were selling up, and that was a big one. There was so many people when we'd go for inspections that were offering above and beyond what the asking price was. And it's really, given how many people are often lining up at some of these houses, really just speaks to the need for so many of us that are currently looking for affordable housing. Debbie, I'm wondering, before we get into the crux of it, I'm wondering, for listeners who may not know much, are you able to tell us a little bit about the First People Disability Network?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, brother. So First People's Disability Network, look, we're an organisation that was founded by some really deadly uncles and aunties in community. And so, you know, just paying our respects to Uncle Lester Bostock, Auntie Gail Rankin, you know, and other significant elders in the community like Auntie Shirley Lomas, who, you know, we started around 21 years ago, and it was back then, you know, all the uncles and the aunts, you know, they seen an absolute need for mob living with a disability to have a voice.
Ooh.
And, you know, it's like, as we know, as Australia, you know, back in the 1940s, but even right through the 1970s, Kevin, you know, we've got to remember that our mothers weren't even allowed to give birth in the hospitals. They were sent down the road.
Ooh.
You know, so disability as a nation, for historically, you know, we've always locked our mob up, or, you know, families with a disability, because it wasn't appropriate to be seen in society. And, you know, I think that mainstream media has had a significant part to play in, you know, how that looks for our families even today. So,
yeah.
I
agree. And it's almost, it doesn't matter, almost any conversation that I have on AAA Let's Talk Social Justice, people are always talking about the role mainstream media play, because we know that they create and have the power to create narratives and to change people's perspectives. And, you know, especially, you know, when we're thinking about our mob with disabilities and for mob and for non-Indigenous people living with disabilities, we know that mainstream media hasn't always treated people with respect. And we know that often their representation isn't always true and accurate. I guess, Debbie Lee, Debbie, are you able to tell us a little bit about your specific role within the First People's Disability Network, and why you got involved with the type of work, I guess, from the first instance?
Yeah. So, look, I'm Jalberry. I live with disability myself. So I have ADHD. I'm on the spectrum. So I have autism, and then I have oppositional defiance disorder. And, you know, look, for me, I living with disability, you know, my kids, my grannies, you know, it was about, I just think it's about making change and, you know, being gifted to be able to help, you know, our family's voices go a little bit further than where they went yesterday. And, yeah, so, look, when I took this role, the reason that I took on this role, because the honest truth was, you know, many of my jobs had been with mainstream organisations, and I found, you know, as an Aboriginal woman living with a disability, that I wasn't very safe when I often would work in those workplaces, and, you know, the culture, our culture came into that a lot.
Yep.
So being with an organisation where every single member of that organisation lives with a disability, or we have family, you know, who have disability, you know, was very much, I guess, you know, my thing, because it allows you to be that agitator, you know.
Yeah,
I think at times, you know, it's just about being in the right place and asking the right questions there.
Absolutely. And for our listeners that might not have thought about this at all before, Debbie Lee, why is disability justice an important issue for blackfellas?
Look, Kevin, why not? You know, I've got to say that, because, you know, we see, if we go right back, right, and if we go back to the beginning of when the settlers came, You know, look, there was so much trauma to our families, to our way of life, to our culture, to, you know, our law even. And, you know, I think that the reason it's so important is because it's one thing to go somewhere and, you know, identify as a black fella.
Yes.
We all know that that still today presents many challenges for many of our families.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, to say that you then have a disability, we are still seeing that that really opens up, you know, the doors for DCJ, Department of Communities and Justice, or, you know, to come in and start looking at removing our children. So there's still a complete misconception that if you're a black fella and you have a disability, somehow that you're doing something wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, so very, very important. And, you know, a good example of that, Kevin, is how many times do we see it at the pub? You know, Unc, you know, might be having a few drinks, but Unc's had a stroke, little does anyone know.
Mm.
And, you know, next minute the bully man's rushing at Uncle because his speech isn't right, and it doesn't matter how many times Uncle tells them, they won't listen. So, and that's just it's a very real thing that is still happening today as we speak, I think across every land, you know.
Absolutely.
No one is not affecting.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more. And as you know, this conversation is part of a series of shows looking at the current housing crisis and its impact on black fellas. To kick off our thinking about housing, can you start by just talking us through some of the reasons that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with disabilities might be more likely to struggle to access safe, secure and affordable housing? And I guess you touched on it a little bit before talking about perceptions.
Look, and, you know, apart from, you know, the issues that we have around, you know, perceptions and things like that, you know, so, for example, what we do know is in the New South Wales state that the average age of any housing stock owned by the government is 52 years old. So, you know, and those houses really had met their life cycle at 35 years, but for our families, we are still required to live in those homes. So not only is there a complete lack of stock, but there's a lack of modified stock.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's the other issue, Kevin, that we still see is that for places like the NDIS, you know, even though under Minister Shorten, you know, who's doing some really good work to see what it looks like, what we've still found is that the agency at times and, you know, with other departments need to continue to learn to work better for outcomes for our families, because what is happening is that 9 times out of 10, you'll go in, you'll tell housing, you know, look, life has changed, this has happened or that's happened, or, you know, I need this because of my disability, my functional, you know, way has changed. And, you know, it's this complete back and forward game, you know, where you're having to prove your disability 10 times over with 3 different assessments. And on the other side of that, you know, we all know that nationally we have a GP shortage and crisis. We have a paediatrician crisis. You know, so to be asking families to go and just duck down the road and get an assessment, Kevin, that ain't going to happen.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And even when you do have all the access and all the resources to access some of these services, like you say, these assessment processes, wait times, people's ability and capacity to complete some of these processes, you know, we're not all starting on the same starting blocks. And this is what I know, that from my years as a social worker working frontline, mostly supporting young people trying to access youth shelters so they could comply with the youth justice, you know, orders. Organisations forgot, policy writers forgot, or they simply didn't care that there are other people within society that might be doing it tougher than others. And I guess particularly for our mob living with disabilities, this is, you know, and then even within that cohort, then you've got folks, you know, who are part of the rainbow community, who are part of the lesbian, gay, trans, intersex, asexual community as well. And so they're just layers and layers upon this. And I'm really thankful for this show being able to really connect with some of those different layers. And as you know, I guess we know that and you've touched on this, we know that there are existing systems and processes for providing housing to people living with disability, but a lot of us probably don't know how much about them. Can you tell us a bit about some of the existing models of disability housing and how they work in practice? For example, the private rental, subsidy, supported living and social housing arrangements?
And I think, you know, it's a good question to sort of cover, because there are so many different models that we can access. But, you know, before we even, as, you know, as blackfellas, before we even look at that access, I think the other important thing to remember here is that for many of our families, brother, we don't even identify as having a disability, you know. So yeah. I'm a 52-year-old Nan, and, you know, like for many years, I never knew what was different about me because nobody ever told me. I just thought, you know, oh, that's strange, you know.
Yep.
But, you know, and that still is the way it is today, very much so in community. And, you know, I think this is something that the governments need to both recognise and acknowledge in its entirety. So not only is there a disproportionate recognition from our governments across many states, but, you know, there's also, you know, that recognition, there needs to be something around maybe presumed access, you know, for mob living with a disability, because aunt might walk into housing, but aunt doesn't actually identify that she has a disability, because we need to remember, Kevin, that's way, and that's white man's words, see?
Yes.
And for us, you know, it might be, no, come on now, hurry up, Johnny, you know, that boy's a bit slow, you know, he muck around there, and that's as far as the conversation goes in community. And, you know, so that's the other thing, is that when we walk into the office of housing, a real estate, a school, it does not matter. But we, you know, we're asked to identify with things that maybe we don't want to, or, you know, maybe for safety, as I said, goes back to the impacts around colonisation as well, you know, that we don't feel safe to identify. And look, that even includes my own kids, Kevin, you know, like I work for the Peak, and my boy will never, ever, ever tell my granny that he has a disability, mate, because he doesn't want that boy to think he's any different in life. And, you know, that's, as a family, that's how we'll manage it. And it's fair to say, I think for a lot of our families, there's still very much that thought process. We have always had to be strong, and, you know, we've always found a way to get on with things. So I think the saddest part about this housing crisis is that mob will do what we always do, and that is, you know, we will survive. And, you know, but that also leaves the door open for these governments not to be responsive. And if I can just say, you know, one of the biggest examples of that is the minister's willingness and commitment under the national and even state closing the gap arrangement. And reforms, you know, we all seen the different approaches from the ministers, and in particular with the Minister for Housing for New South Wales. Very, very disappointing to see that our ministers can't even accept the bare minimum national code of construction standards. Because what that means, brother, so, you know, if you got mob out in Bourke there, or and you're by a cross-border community or state or communities like Wreck Bay, which are under New South Wales servicing arrangements. What you know, what that actually means is that they'll miss out twice as much, really.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. And, you know, we talk about these different layers in terms of accessing housing, and we talk about, you know, in terms of blackfellas' experiences, you know, we've got the issue of racism. You know, we're speaking to you today about, you know, the challenges that our mob with disabilities face. There's also the extra layer, you know, as a gay man, I know in terms of people from the rainbow community accessing housing. And I think it's really important that you touched on Bourke and other places because, you know, I'm sitting here, you know, in West End, you know, in the city of Meange and Brizzy here, but we know that the further out you go, the less and less opportunities that our mob have access to, right?
And I think it's fair to say, brother, another thing that is bubbling up for many of our families, and I think on a national level, is the fact that, you know, when some of our babies do have really severe disability and, you know, they need a little bit more care than what we can give them, what we're also finding is that they're quite often being forced to go off country to get those placements. You know, the other thing I probably should touch on is, you know, for a lot of our families, we all know there's really two levels of disability. And that is, you know, disability that you can see and disability that you can't see. So when it enters the land of, you know, it's a disability that you can't see, you know, quite often that's even harder, 10 times harder again. And, you know, obviously this very much feeds into, you know, the rates of incarceration for our mob, you know, men and women now. You know, because still, again, we have a government system that does not wish to acknowledge, you know, disability and just say, oi, unk, you're right, you know, like, what's going on with you? You know, when that those processes are quite often being missed, you know, in significant ways, which obviously is going to see us, you know, do things a lot tougher than what they are right now.
Absolutely. And, you know, we talk about assessments in terms of housing, but even when we're talking about assessments to be diagnosed with a particular condition, they can be often very invasive. They can be very expensive. And you touched on processes. If you don't have someone supporting you, particularly if you have an undiagnosed condition, it can be extra challenging just to even get a diagnosis. I know in my work supporting young people in the youth justice space, even to try and get something like an assessment for fetal alcohol syndrome disorder, you know, that was a $5,000, and this was, you know, going back 18 months ago, and that was at the time $5,000. And I know that different assessments along the spectrum vary in prices and vary in wait times as well. I'm wondering, Debbie Lee, does the current crisis in rental affordability and accessibility impact the provision of housing for people with disabilities? And how do changes in the private rental market impact other systems of disability housing?
Oh, look, Kevin, absolutely. Yeah, they have full impact on the housing system. You know, and I think that as a nation, it would be remiss of us to actually say that the issue does not exist, because the issues are quite often walking hand in hand. So, you know, it goes back to that whole thing. Even if you are, if you can get a house, you then might need the modifications to occur. You know, so therefore it goes back to, you know, you've got to have the assessment, you've got to find the money, you know, and quite often, you know, if we push out to some of our further communities and, you know, look, that could be a 3-hour drive. It could actually be a 5-hour drive. And, you know, for First Peoples, you know, we often hear stories of uncles and aunts living a long way away. As we know, the roads out here were not fixed after the floods, making them extremely dangerous for our aunts and uncles and that. And, You know, like they'd be driving a couple of hours, they turn up at the hospital for their appointment, the hospital, the staff go, oh, sorry, I got the day wrong, you know, bit of a giggle, but that's just cost $200 or $300, and let's be honest, that's all their money for a couple of weeks. Not only that, that's leaving, you know, aunt and uncle to drive home in the dark, you know, just not, not acceptable, but then... How do we as a nation, or how does the government, you know, are they monitoring that? No. And there, you know, seems to be very little correlation on, you know, how one thing is dominoing on top of the other thing. And, you know, look, I suppose the other part of that is too, you know, and the honest truth is here, if we talk about accessibility and the private rental market, so to give you an idea, if, you know, you've got a big family, you're looking for a new rental, you were just, you know, kicked out your other one, you know, for whatever reason, you know, you walk into a real estate office 7 and you've got three of your kids behind you, you ain't likely to get that house.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, the truth is, it is likely to go to somebody else before it will go to the family, you know, living with a disability. And, you know, look, as I said, and we're seeing more and more of these stories being exposed now, but this, you know, is also allowing for landlords to, you know, really take advantage of and place families in really risky health situations. So a lot of our families who do have accommodation, it is completely substandard. And when I say substandard, I'm only talking even New South Wales, not even what I would consider remote, where aunts and uncles are being left without hot water. You know, the roofs are actually caving in because those social housing providers don't have the ability to maintain or fix them. And, yeah, so what we're actually finding is, you know, for example, if aunt or, you know, whatever, or, you know, she got a couple of little bubbers, and they've been left in the house full of mould, you know, what started as a health condition ends up landing as a disability.
Yeah, and thank you for touching on, you know, some of the, I guess, some of those challenges that our mob experience in overcrowding. I mean, for many of us, and I know some parts are still impacted worse than others, but for many of us, we're slowly coming out of this global pandemic. I mean, Debbie Lee, when we think about overcrowding, there was an entire virus that swept the globe whereby close proximity was going to exacerbate your chances of a getting COVID, but also be the severity of it. And we know that a lot of our mob were pushed in, and as you say, pushed into overcrowded living circumstances because the challenges that they're experiencing across the board are just, immeasurable. And we know that there's a myriad of different health conditions attached to overcrowding. Obviously, I've touched on COVID, given that that's the most recent sort of thing that we've come through. But as you say, you know, mold, you know, access to clean water and to warm water and what that has. So I'm glad that you touched on that because I guess not everyone thinks about that. Debbie Lee, I'm wondering, does disability, when we think about disability justice, what does it mean to you and how might it help us respond to the current housing crisis?
Look, I think the answer is so simple there, brother. You know, we once had a system with justice where, you know, as a sister or brother before we got released, you know, 3 months out from our release date, they actually had to have a plan. You know, and I'm talking, let's go back 20 years ago. You know, a brother would get out of jail, well, he would be met, you know, if he didn't have family to pick him up, he had, you know, someone from the Salvation Army or somebody, right, was going to meet him on the other side of the gate. They helped him make sure his Centrelink was on because quite often, you know, you get released, you know, you certainly don't have all your ID with you. And, you know, so they would help organise, you know, make sure you're on your payment, make sure this was right, make sure you had your accommodation. But the problem with our justice system here today is that there's an, it's a standard, one of the youngs, he gets out of jail here. First of all, he gets out, and let's say just even Wellington as an example, well, there's no public bus going out to Wellington jail.
Yeah.
At midnight. And quite often we are seeing our brothers and sisters be released close at a midnight on many occasions now. And what's happening is that's leaving them, they're straight out of jail, having a hitchhike. They've got no safe accommodation, which, gives two choices, a couple of choices. You either return to what you know, and, or you can go and stay at the emergency department at the hospital, because otherwise you're in breach of your parole.
Yeah.
This is it's a major issue, and I think, for our governments, there is a significant opportunity here to look at how they are doing this differently. And, for example, that was the adult justice system, but even for our youth, for our little mooks out there, Kevin, we're actually seeing a lot of the courthouses right across the state, so I imagine this is a national issue as well. That, these kids are going to court, no support, no ACLO, there's no Koori Kids Court, there's no circle sentencing, there's really nothing in that area. It impacts on their housing, and ability to even get housing. But the other, what I did want to acknowledge, and my apologies to everyone because I did forget that. But I also wanted to acknowledge within this conversation that there's another layer of mob getting heavily impacted, and that is our stolen generation.
Yeah.
So, look, we still have many aunts and uncles out there, Kevin, who don't even have a birth certificate. So, how do they actually go and apply for a house? When, even if you've got an application in with LinkUp, it could take a year or 2 years to reconnect ID. So that literally means, by way of design, that aunt or uncle is then homeless for the next 2 years just due to, identification, when we all know as a nation that, it was the assimilation policy that created those impacts to our families. So, I think there is opportunity for our governments to look at, again, presumed access and, to speed up that process and not disadvantage people any further than they need to.
Yeah, and only a couple of weeks ago, might have been last week, we had Kylie Dean from the West End Community House here in Meange and Brizzy, and she also touched on those processes as well, and, things like identification, not having that and not having a fixed address, and how that actually impacts you being able to even apply for, housing. And I think that's something a lot of people don't consider is not everyone has access to, their formal identification documents. And when you are sleeping rough or when you have had to move house multiple times, these are the type of documents that get lost. And without it, it's very hard to even start the process. So I'm really thankful that you touched on that as well. And then when we think about our mob, living with disabilities and the extra challenges that they might have in going through that process, even with a support person, they can be very challenging. Debbie Lee, thank you for joining me this morning. It's been an absolute pleasure. I'm wondering, before I go, how can listeners get involved with or support the work that you and your colleagues are doing at First Peoples Disability Network?
Oh, thank you, brother. Look, I think the best thing is, First Peoples Disability Network, we operate nationally, although we are a very small team of mobs. We are growing, but what I would say is if that you are interested, the best way is just give us a ring, have a yarn to somebody. Somebody will pick up that phone on the other end. It doesn't matter where you live, what country you're on, how remote you are. It doesn't matter. You can be Woodjil Woodjil, you can be Sejuna, you can be in Bourke. Maria, it doesn't matter where you are. There is always opportunity to connect with FPDN, So, what I would say is you know, we have advocacy. We are currently in process of, you know, getting accredited for national advocacy. We do national sector strengthening work on just trying to change attitudes, training, education and perception in places like justice and housing.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so I'd say, you know, if you have an interest, you know what, just ring us and have a yarn, because it might be that, you know what, you have a 19-year-old kid and you're just looking for more for your boy to do, and, you know, we might be talking and all of a sudden we realise, hey, you know, there's this opportunity here that might fit really well for you. Yeah, but I would say just give someone a call or jump online. You can always check us out, or got social media if, you know, if that's a bit easier.
Awesome. Thank you, Debbie Lee. I know that you are a busy person, so I can't thank you enough for jumping on the airwaves today with me with AAA Let's Talk Social Justice. The work that you and your colleagues do at the First People's Disability Network is immeasurable, and I can't imagine that there are a lot of these services that are available to our mob. So all the power to you, and I take my hat off to you, and thank you for all the work that you're doing in holding down the front line. And folks, if you'd like to recap that really deadly critical conversation, you know that you can follow us online on our social medias, or you can jump on the AAA website or head over to Spotify to recap this yarn or any of the other yarns that we've had around the Housing Justice series or any of the previous ones in the year. Debbie Lee from First People's Disability Network, thank you very much for joining me this morning. It's been an absolute pleasure.
You're welcome, my brother, and stay safe and stay deadly. But what I'd say to any family that's out there, you know, if you are having issues around disability, it doesn't matter whether it's diagnosed, undiagnosed, you know, if you need somebody to talk to, you know, and you don't know where to go, as I said, give somebody from FPN a call and, you know, somebody will give you a ring back and, you know, we'll try and point you in the right direction there.
Deadly, thank you so much. And for listeners, you can catch me back next Tuesday morning. I'll be back with our next yarn. And, yeah, if you want to follow my adventures, you can follow me on Instagram, kevin.yaoyi, or Twitter, kevinyaoyi. Thank you. We'll talk next week. Bye.
No more whispering in our mind.
Let's talk Monday to Friday at 9 a.m. on AAA Murray Country, the National Indigenous Radio Service and iHeartRadio. You can catch up on AAA.org.au, proudly supported by the Community Broadcast Foundation.